From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than half a million Americans are homeless, and not just in cities. It's a pressing issue across the country, including in rural Georgia. In metro Atlanta, more than 3,000 people live on the streets, in shelters, in cars. People you may drive or walk past every day, often with little idea and often plenty of assumptions about who they are and how they got there. A new traveling museum uses stories, photos, and virtual reality to give visitors a sense of what it's like to be homeless. Terrence Lester is with us. He's founder of Love Beyond Walls, and that's the organization behind the new Dignity Museum, the first of its kind. Terrence, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. It's you and your wife, Cecilia, who started the nonprofit Love Beyond Walls. It's about 5 years ago. First of all, that name, what inspired it?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, especially like the climate in our country, there are a lot of walls that divide us, right? A lot of isms. And so we believe that love is a powerful force and able to break down walls. And so what greater way to, I guess, crystallize what our heartbeat is than to name it Love Beyond Walls? How do we take love into places where it doesn't exist?
Well, that's what you do daily. But how do you do that on the ground? What's a typical day like for you at Love Beyond Walls?
Yeah, so our center is based in Atlanta, close to the airport. And so that's anything from providing services for families experiencing poverty or homelessness. That could be making connections for individuals who are seeking job employment. That could be mobilizing volunteers to teach classes, such as trades. Like, we've had classes where guys and gals were able to learn carpentry skills. It's anything from just giving people a shower. You know, we have individuals that come to our space sometimes, and they are hopeless many times because they were put out of a restaurant for trying to access public water or anything. I mean, it's just, we create this intentional community where people could come and receive some of the services that they may need. Yeah. And that's 5 days a week. We normally see about 500 to 700 people a month. Wow. On average. Anything from mothers needing groceries. I remember one time we had this mom. She walked 2 miles with her daughter, and her child was, I think, less than 12 months. And she said that she had been giving her daughter spaghetti sauce for baby food.
Mm.
You know, the number of moms that come to our center sometimes that just don't have diapers for their kids. I mean, We're full on and ready to address whatever need it is that people have when they come to our center.
So there's all this work that's helping people directly on the streets, going out and giving clothing, that kind of thing, the services you just described. So why create a museum?
Yeah, because I think there's a distance in understanding, right? We've all heard secondhand information, whether we've caught glimpses of why people are experiencing poverty from a media outlets or what we heard growing up based upon our environments. And it's like some of those thoughts that we've kind of developed create bias and form stereotypes in our minds. And it's like we have these thoughts towards individuals going through the plight, but we've never gotten it from the source, right? What does it mean to create a space where instead of bringing maybe bias or your prejudice or your stereotype, dismissing somebody? Because we could justify, we could dismiss somebody just based upon a simple thought that we may have, and we never meet the person on the other side of the story. And so we wanted to create this space where people going through the suffering could speak for themselves, you know, where, you know, we've seen people very dismissive, make just like rash judgments about people, right? Or they may have have a mental health issue, or why don't you just go and get a job? You hear all these things, and it's like, have you had a chance to even meet or hear that person's story. They have a unique experience, and we want to allow the people who have to carry the brunt of suffering to speak for themselves so they can educate the public. It's like an inverted process, right? Normally, we want to stand like on higher ground, so to speak, and speak down to people. But it's like another thing where you invert the process, and you have to take the, you have to become the student. You have to listen to the stories in which people are going through, which, like, you know, educates people and tears down, you know, false narratives. Yeah.
Let's hear one of the stories. Part of what you do is center their stories. Like, you know, we walk into a museum, you watch a little film, or you stand there and look at something, and instead of a work of art, you've got people's stories there. And here's one of them. There's an app in the museum that plays their narrations of people who are homeless. Among them, here is Ronald Davis.
It's really humiliating to be shaking a cup 24 hours a day and people just look at you like you're some kind of little bum, you know what I'm saying? I mean, I have had people to walk past me and say, get a job, bum. And I said, wait a minute, I'm not a bum, I'm a human being. And it's hard. But after the end of the day, when people go home and everybody get on the metro train, and then my, and then I just feel so bad that I can't be going on.
That is Ronald Davis. He is among the stories told at the new Dignity Museum. I'm speaking with Terrence Lester. He's one of the founders of it. His group, Love Beyond Walls, put it together. So give us a little sense of it. This is a container, a shipping container, divided into three rooms, each presenting a different way of understanding homelessness. So what are people going to see? Give us a little radio narration tour.
Yeah. Firstly, it is housed in a shipping container. And one of the things that we wanted to drive home as people enter into the space is that shipping containers themselves are transient. And every shipping container has a story. And every shipping container carries something that is of worth and value. And what a great metaphor for people experiencing homelessness and poverty. Many people are transient. Many people move around from place to place, but that does not mean that they don't have worth and value on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. And so we renovated the space, and when you walk in, you have a museum feel where there is art on the walls, but it's not the type of art that you would see in the museum. It's thoughts that people experiencing homelessness have, like their actual thoughts and fears we've captured. We've captured phrases from people and what they've placed on signs. So the museum itself is broken down into three phases. Is the challenging the stereotypes. You know, you'll engage in like audio content. You have we distribute you a phone, and there's an app on the phone, and you hover over an iPad station. We use technology where it pulls up audio clips of people that will challenge your stereotypes. There's content on the wall that breaks down myths and facts. And then you move into like the empathy section, right? It's create empathy section. And there's a virtual reality headset where you literally are transported onto the street, and you have someone sitting literally in trash, surrounded in trash, and they're telling you their story. Like one gentleman, he's saying, I hope I don't die this winter. And you're able to look around and see the conditions in which a person lives. And then towards the end, we wanted to really be intentional about inspiring action. We normally hear a lot of, well, that's the government's problem, or that's communities of faith. They should do something about it. But we really try to inspire people to see, what are your gifts? What are your talents? What are your abilities? What are you doing to get involved in addressing this issue? Because it's going to take all of us. You know, Martin Luther King was famous for saying that we are a global village, a global community, that we're all interwoven together, right? And I normally use the metaphor of if you have a piece of clothing and a string starts to unravel, you don't throw away the entire piece, right? And I think that's kind of like what we do. We see strings of people like unraveling their lives, or maybe not like ours, and we just pull it and we dismiss and we kind of throw it away. But nobody would throw away the whole garment, right? And so, because the string is still a part of the entire piece of cloth, and so what I'm trying to get people to understand is that you're connected to your neighbor. You're connected to individuals that are suffering, because if somebody else is suffering, we're all suffering.
Yeah, so yeah. You're tying off that little string. And yeah. And just hearing Ronald's story, I mean, it's heartbreaking. I am a human being, and
yes.
it's impossible for me not to be moved by that. And I'm sorry to have heard that Ronald has since died.
Yeah.
Do a lot of people die on the streets?
Yeah, many, especially during the winter. You know, it was reported just here in Atlanta that a lot of people lost their lives on the street this past winter. Just from, you know, the cold weather, freezing to death.
Well, I've heard a lot of people debate whether or not to give money to a homeless person who asks for it, you know, walking with somebody or in a car with somebody. And some say, well, it's better not to give to organizations that can help. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I try to model what I call lifestyle service, right? And so I create the mental margin and the margin in my life that when a person approaches me, I'm looking at them in their face, in their eyes. I'm not just being dismissive because I may or may not have funds to give them. I'm asking them their stories. I'm taking time to get to know them. And then I made myself knowledgeable, right? You have to be resourceful of resources that a person may or may not know, you know, because when you're living on the streets, you don't have readily access to technology, right? And there may be a phone number or a place close by that you could even make the person aware of. Normally, I don't give money unless it's like an extreme emergency. I try to address the issue like head on. I remember one time I was in Chicago, and this guy, he walks up to me. He says, man, I'm hungry. Like, I haven't eaten in a few days. Could you give me some money to get something to eat? And so I was headed somewhere, but I said, man, you know what? I asked him his name. His name was Brian. I got to know his story. I said, you want something to eat? I'm going to walk you into a restaurant right now. And it was powerful in that we walked through this restaurant and it was just like in concert. All of the workers looked at him in disgust, and it made me feel so uncomfortable because he's a friend now. We're walking in, and you're looking. It made me want to buy everything in the restaurant and just give it to him because here it is. Like, people were standing in judgment of this man. And so he got a meal. We got a meal, and we sat there, and we shared. And then I researched information to get him connected to organizations around his particular region, yeah.
Well, Terrence Lester, I want to keep talking with you about the new Dignity Museum, the first of its kind. It's a traveling museum starting here in Atlanta. Terrence is the founder of Love Beyond Walls, and it's an organization that helps the homeless. We're going to be back with him in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Georgia's newest museum was not designed by a star architect. There's no cafe, no gift shop. It's a few shipping containers in a parking lot that uses stories and virtual reality to understand the experience of being homeless. Terrence Lester is with us. He is founder of Love Beyond Walls, and that is the organization behind what is called the new Dignity Museum. It is the first of its kind. Well, Terrence, you were just talking about the, you know, building bridges and having interactions with people who are homeless and looking for money on the street. For most people, you know, maybe they give a little bit of money, they buy them a meal, and that's the end of the encounter. You're encouraging interaction. How realistic is that on someone's way to work, or how else can somebody help, I guess, is the better question.
Yeah. How realistic is it? I think it's very realistic. I'm not advocating for people to, you know, be late to work. I'm asking people to take time to notice. I'm asking people to create intentional margin in their lifestyle to give of themselves for service, right? You know, the normal everyday person wants to give back in some way, but the first thing you do when you ask them, can you come, can you get involved, can you do this, the first thing they're going to tell you is, I'm busy. And most times, most people's calendars are filled with things that really don't even matter, right? I'm advocating for a reimagining of how you have architect or like designed your lifestyle. Service is not an event, it's a lifestyle. And so you do things like removing one thing off of your plate to create intentional time for yourself to give of yourself in service. I'll never forget, I had this this lady who created just intentional time. She said she was going to like start volunteering, you know, a couple hours a week. And so during that time, we had met a guy named Ronald. He was living on the streets. We kind of like befriended him. Come to find out, Ronald hadn't been in touch with his family in 30 years. Now, this person that was given their time, she had a knack for research, right? And this guy who we had just befriended, he hadn't been in contact with his family for 30 years. She came down 3 to 4 hours a week for a couple of weeks, researched and literally found his family for him. He was able to get in contact with his family that he hadn't been in contact with in 30 years. He found out his mom passed, his dad passed, many of his siblings passed, and there was a sibling that was still alive. And he was able to talk to his sibling for the first time in 30 years just from somebody creating an intentional time in their lifestyle to give of themselves. That's what I'm advocating for.
Well, you talked a little bit before about the inverted pyramid, the idea of standing on high and looking at a problem. And I know many people who have volunteered for homelessness. And I wonder, I also heard some of the assumptions about what they're doing and how they are helping. How do you help change that dynamic, that relationship of like, I'm here to help you, homeless person? You know what I mean? That that kind of there's a kind of there can be a grandiosity with it.
Yeah. Almost like this. Like you want to pat yourself on the back.
Right. I'm really so proud. I'm doing something good.
I'm doing this for you, but I'm really doing it for myself, in a hidden manner. Yeah. We push back against that because we're advocating for authentic relationships to happen. For instance, this past weekend, we launched a museum, and I got a chance to honor my friend Mark Moore. Mark Moore was one of the guys that was digging in a dumpster behind our building. Instead of calling the police, I befriended him. Found out that he had a degree in business. He used to work in corporate America. And he had been living on the streets for the past seven years. Well, we surrounded him with a community. It was not the type of community where it's like, you're down here, we're up here. He needed support. He needed relationship. He needed encouragement. And so he stayed with us about a year. It took us 8 months to get his birth certificate. 8 months. We solicited his home state, and it took an eight-month process. And the funny thing is, you need ID to get ID, right? Which is weird. Like, you know, that you can fingerprint when you're a criminal, and it'll pull everything up. But, like, when you are living on the streets, you need ID to get ID. And so we went through that process, and we launched a campaign called Hire Mark, and it shared his story. And within 6 days, he got a job after he got his ID back. And 2 weeks after that, he was back in corporate America. He was able to come back and speak on behalf of the Dignity Museum this past weekend. And I didn't look at him like, you know, he was somebody beneath me. I learned from him during the process. He had wisdom. He read books. And he was able to speak to the crowd. And he said, you know, I remember going to this coffee shop down the street. And when I was homeless, they would call the police and they would ask me for my identification. And now I dress better and I smell better and I look better. They asked me, do I own the place, right? And basically what he was trying to say was nothing changed on the inside of me. I was the same person. Mm-hmm. He says, although I experienced homelessness, my character never changed. And now that I'm in corporate America now, my character hasn't changed. I'm the same person. And that's what I'm advocating for people to see past where people are, because people aren't problems. They're people going through problems.
Well, I think oftentimes it's hard because of, you mentioned earlier, just giving people showers makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
One of the stories from the at the museum is Fatima. This is a woman describing her struggles with homelessness.
As a woman, the hardest part of being homeless is when you can't bathe. It's very important for a woman to bathe. And when you can't bathe, like in the wintertime, it's hard, ugly. What people can do to help me is pray for me. I would like everybody to pray for me that I do get off the streets and not become homeless anymore.
So that's Fatima, one of the stories that we hear at the Dignity Museum. I'm speaking with Terrence Lester. He's one of the founders of the museum. His organization, Love Beyond Walls, is behind it. So, but hearing that story, like, you know, how many showers does one go before you are no longer welcome inside of a coffee shop, inside of, you know, this kind of cascading, I imagine, day after day after day, you just get further and further away from the places where people who are not homeless can go, right? Or are welcome, let me put it that way.
Yeah, like your sense of normalcy, right? Like, you know, there are many things that actually causes homelessness, but one of the things that sticks out to me, because, you know, I had personal experiences with homelessness myself. Most people won't even know. I have 4 degrees now. I have a family, etc. But when I was a teen, I ran away from home and I lived out of my car. I lived in parks because I had my own struggles stemming from my family, right? Uh-huh. And so it wasn't until strangers befriended me, mentors came into my life. I was plugged into like communities of faith and the whole nine that spoke, you know, and called out, you know, my true potential, that I was able to overcome and think of myself better than my experiences. But it goes back to this point I want to make. Some people that experience the plight of poverty and homelessness have a lack of trustworthy relationships, right? Everybody wants to have a great family or, you know, best friends and all that jazz. But, like, sometimes people are literally socially isolated. Mm-hmm. And how debilitating that is to, like, have people pass by you all the time. You don't have like Mark Zuckerberg as a cousin to, or Warren Buffett to call and, you know, access money if you fall on bad times, or you don't have anybody with like a counseling degree to like sit and listen to your problems and all these things. And sometimes it's just a lack of stable relationships, you know, that people suffer with. Or about how about like personal hardships? Like, we all go through, you know, many hardships. Like, if you were to have a hardship to happen to you, I normally ask people, name a couple people that you could call right away that would come to your aid.
Mm-hmm.
And they could rattle that off. But when you talk to a person that is out there, normally it's nobody. Imagine being in that space where it's just you, you know? And then you got affordable housing, right? Prices are skyrocketing all across the country and city, like metropolitan areas. And, you know, majority of the states have a national minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. You know, just think about trying to survive on less than $1,000 a month, right? And you got bills, you got rent, you have, you know, all of the things that keeps your life stable. And then, you know, it's this whole deal of, you know, am I making a living wage? Most people have a perception that poor people don't work hard. And my rebuttal to that is that they may work harder than anybody else, right? 40, 50, 60 hours a week, but because they don't make a living wage, it's hard to maintain.
Right, and here in Georgia, it's not even up to the federal minimum wage. Mm. But you're touching on a couple of things, you know, family dynamics, stability,
yeah.
and if you grew up in a place that doesn't feel safe to you,
yeah.
for whatever reason, but then compounding that are often mental health issues. I have a lot of that in my own family,
yep.
You know, severe psychosis,
yes.
Schizophrenia.
Yep.
And then there's substance and mental substance abuse,
yeah.
you know, and that can be self-medicating.
Yes.
People
yeah.
find themselves like trying to obliterate whatever memories or whatever has gone on for them
yeah.
or voices they quiet. So how do you go about addressing these like are serious critical issues, mental health issues, substance abuse issues in the populations that you work with?
Yeah. Right now we have... you know, try tirelessly to help make connections with people for jobs using our networks. Like when we really invest in a person, when I say invest in a person, I'm not talking about talking down about people. I'm talking about like on an even playing field, like spending time with getting to know their stories or such. And we feel comfortable and getting them to a point where we could you know, advocate for them to get a, you know, sustainable job, then we do that. We've done everything from like, you know, creating houses out of RVs. We used to have, you know, families donating us RVs, just places for people to stay. One of the things I'm really passionate about right now is this idea of creating housing for people experiencing homelessness and poverty. One of the things I want to do with this museum is that when guests visit and they make a contribution, that we want to use those proceeds to actually create housing for the individuals that we encounter on a day-to-day.
I just keep going back to Ronald and Fatima. You know, I'm a human being, and we talked a little bit about judgments people make about people on the street. And I'm wondering if you heard people talking about that first time they had to ask a stranger for help or for money. Like, what does that take?
Yeah. I remember when I first started Love Beyond Walls, the very first campaign that I did was I made myself homeless for over a month with the permission of my family. I lived under a bridge in the heart of the city of Atlanta. Befriended a community there, and I remember it was during the winter time, and me and my friend Tony, we had to walk a couple miles just to use the restroom, and it was that day. He was like, "Man, I'm not feeling well," and I asked him like, "What's going on?" He told me he had a illness, right, that he had contracted, and you know, I was like, "Man, well, how do we get your medication?" And he was like, "We're going to have to stand on a corner and beg for money." We created a sign. We stood right downtown in the heart of the city. We asked 427 people for a dollar. We only got 11. Not to mention it was like below 20 degrees outside while this was happening. So I know firsthand like what it's like when you're out there trying to ask for money and people think it's for alcohol or drugs. And I was just out there trying to help my friend raise funds for his medication. And I'm not saying that all people aren't out there, you know, asking for money for alcohol or something like that, but I'm saying there are some people out there in the world that really need your help desperately.
Well, Terrence, it's fascinating to speak with you, and I can't wait to go to the museum. I haven't been myself yet, but we have just 2 minutes left, and I'm wondering, you know, of all the choices
yeah.
people have of like things that they want to do in town, I'm going to go to a museum and hear about the experience of homeless people. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
How do you draw people there? How does that experience... What's been the response that people have talked about having been there this weekend?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not just walking through a container. We have stations that go around. Like, one of the stations is called Digging Deeper. Literally, intentionally, we have trash cans. And at the bottom of the trash cans are plates. And on the plates are phrases. and people have to dig in a trash can, and the intention is to make them think that somebody ate out of a trash can a day, and it sparks conversation. There's another station where they are forced to create their own sign. What would you put on the sign if you were out and you needed to raise change to wash your clothes because you've been wearing the same clothes for the last 7 days? You would be amazed at the responses children gave. You know, one little girl said, "Please help. My clothes are dirty. Would you help me change?" But the intention is to create this understanding that goes deeper than just, you know, the surface level thinking. And I think people are drawn to it because they really want to hear the stories that they didn't never get a chance to hear. Yeah.
Terrence Lester, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Yeah, thank you.
Terrence Lester is founder of Love Beyond Walls and the Dignity Museum, now in Atlanta. It's going to be traveling onward, so catch it now. Admission is free. Donations are accepted. And as Terrence said, we'll go towards housing for the homeless. More information is on our website, gpbnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Savannah Harbor expansion is a $706 million project. The aim is to dredge 32 miles of the Savannah River to let in supersized freighters from the Panama Canal. The dredging project would also make room for another waterborne species, the short-nosed sturgeon. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers proposes constructing a rock weir to allow the endangered fish access to its historic spawning ground. Well, the proposal has stirred up arguments in communities along Georgia waterways. GPB's Drew Dawson is station manager of GPB's Augusta Bureau, also our midday host, and he's been following the debate on the line from Augusta right now. Hello, Drew.
Hey, Virginia, how are you?
Very well, and really interested in this story. To start, the Corps of Engineers has to be aware of environmental impacts during the expansion. So how does the short-nosed sturgeon come into all this?
Well, interestingly, it's not only the short-nosed sturgeon, it's also the Atlantic sturgeon, two different breeds of the fish. And the problem has been that because there was a lock-in dam placed about 19 miles south of downtown Augusta back in the 1930s for navigation purposes and for the purposes of trade on the river, the sturgeon haven't been able to make it upstream to their normal spawning grounds, which is the Augusta Shoals. Mm. So now what they're saying is that because of the Endangered Species Act, both of these fish breeds, if you will, are entitled to special protections. And with the funding for the Savannah Harbor expansion also comes the funding for some environmental remediation. And this is one of the parts of that. Now, I have to tell you, I've talked to people up and down the Augusta area of the river on this, and they tell me they've never seen a sturgeon in the river, which could make the case for why it's necessary to remove the lock and dam, but it also could make the case for, hey, these fish aren't really here anyway. So there's some debate on both sides as to the practicality and the need for making the move that they're talking about here.
Well, so let's dig into that. The fish haven't been able to access their historic spawning ground since 1937, when this original lock and dam system built. So is this why they are an endangered species, or have they just found someplace else to spawn?
Yes and yes. They are partially endangered because of the fact that from what I've read and from what I've heard from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, these particular breeds of fish like to breed on hard surfaces in shallow waters like the Augusta Shoals. So what's happened, so I've been told, is that the fish have come up the river and they've gotten to the dam, the lock and dam, and sort of kind of stopped there. Problem is that the ground underneath that is very, very soft sediment rather than the hard surface that they like to breed on. And the folks at NOAA tell me that they've actually tagged some of these fish and seen them come up to the dam, stop, turn around, and go back downriver. Now, my question was, if these fish haven't been able to get upstream since 1937, why do we think that this will happen at this point? And they tell me that it's not so much that there's some magical geolocator that takes them back to the place where they were born. What it is they follow the flow of the river. In other words, if there's a headwater coming down toward them, they're going to swim right through that and keep on going until they get to the place that they think they want to breed. Mm-hmm. So the expectation is that once the dam is removed and the rock weir or whatever ends up there is put in, the fish will keep on swimming upriver and say, oh, I'm still swimming into a headwind, so to speak, so let me keep going. And eventually they'll get to the shoals and say, this is good breeding ground for
mm-hmm.
me. And one of the things I should mention, just anecdotally here, Virginia, is that people may not be familiar with just how magnificent these fish are. When you talk to someone from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they don't refer to them as fish. They refer to them as animals. Subtle, but important. There's two kinds of fish there we're talking about. We're talking about the short-nosed sturgeon and also the Atlantic sturgeon. The short-nosed sturgeon grow to be about 5 feet long, weigh as much as 60 pounds, and live 10 to 20 years. The Atlantic sturgeon grow to be as much as 14 feet long,
oh my goodness,
weigh up to 800 pounds, and live as long as 60 years. So they're pretty impressive animals, fish, if you will, that they're talking about here. And, you know, because most people who live along the river have never, ever seen one, there's, you know, the perception that, hey, we're just talking about some fish. Well, the Endangered Species Act says, yeah, but these are pretty special fish. They've been around for 250 million years, and they're not the kind of thing you're going to catch with a rod and a reel. These are large, large creatures that are impacted by all this.
Well, the Corps of Engineers is planning to construct this rock weir in the Savannah River as a replacement for the current lock and dam. You talked about how the fish would experience, but how would the systems themselves differ?
Picture this as a retaining wall that you might see in somebody's landscaping, where one end is very, very high and then it sort of kind of steps down to the lawn area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is what they're talking about doing, putting a 500-foot wide rock weir in place of the dam, so the water will still come over, but the fish will be able to swim up it and get over it and then get into the area where the shoals are. The goal, of course, is to try to preserve some or all of the pool, the water level through downtown Augusta, where everybody is squawking about the changes that that this will cause. Now, I will tell you that I've spoken to not only the folks from NOAA, but also the folks from the Savannah Riverkeeper, and they remind me that although we need to be concerned about the residents who live along the river, and the residents who live along the river are the ones who are concerned about the water level dropping, that's really not the Army Corps of Engineers concerned. They are trying to live up to the terms of the Endangered Species Act, which says we got to make a way for these sturgeon to get back to their historic spawning grounds. And then secondarily, they're concerned about making sure that the industries along the river maintain access to that water. So the city of North Augusta, the city of Augusta, some major industries that are along the river all need to pull water from this river. And so when they did the tests in February, lowering the water level down to what it would be if this rock weir was in place, the industries could still get their water, the cities could still get their water, the fish could get upstream, and the residents in it who live along the water are sort of kind of out in the cold on this one because, as the government officials tell us, they knew what they were getting into when they moved there. They're subject to the rules that govern the river, not so much the river being subject to what their preferences are as far as preserving their property is concerned.
Okay, so you that's what happened. The Corps ran a simulation of the effect of the rock weir versus the dam. So what exactly happened? Did the river go down significantly?
Oh, yes, it did. Absolutely. The water level through downtown dropped, depending on where you were looking and officially measuring, as much as 4 or 5 feet.
Now, wow.
What that means is that if you had a dock and you have a beautiful house on the North Augusta side of the river, and you have a dock that comes off your property and drops down into the river where your boat is docked, your dock was sitting on mudflats. On the Augusta side, particularly as it moved along the Riverwalk, which is a big tourist and, you know, recreational area for downtown Augusta,
mm-hmm.
The water dropped 4 feet along the retaining walls and left exposed a nice stain. And, Virginia, the stench was just absolutely unbelievable as far as, you know, the drying seaweed and what have you. But more importantly than that, with the water level so low, obstructions that had been buried underneath the river, old dock pilings, there's a wall that actually goes down the middle of a river from an earlier Army Corps of Engineers project early in the last century. That was coming up to the place where it wasn't safe for boating anymore either. But again, the Army Corps of Engineers' concern isn't that. They're concerned about the fish, and they're concerned about the water intake from those industries and utilities. So from their standpoint, this test was fine, but the residents, of course, squawked and screamed and let their feelings be known that the plan that's been outlined is not acceptable for them.
Somebody who does see an upside, Riverkeeper Tanya Bonitatibus. Here she is describing what she noticed.
We're very excited because Fish Passage is happening, but we also recognize that this is a real good opportunity because the pool's being protected. That lock and dam was going to fall in. It's been in really bad shape for a long time. So seeing this move forward and knowing that at least something will be put in place to keep that water level higher is important.
All right, so you've got your commercial interests, recreational interests, real estate interests, and of course, environmentalist interest. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, they extended the period for public comment from community members to give their feedback. Among those who registered, Augusta resident Steve Gray.
There was nothing in the report that indicated they care about that sort of impact. There will be similar impacts on the cities on both sides, which have public improvements, parks, etc., along the river. I don't see where the plan provides anything for compensation for that.
That is Augusta resident Steve Gray, one of those that my colleague Drew Dawson spoke to during the public comment period. By the way, the community members have until April 16th to give their feedback on this proposed plan of a rock weir or some other alternative along the river in there in Augusta. So what else have you been hearing from the public?
Well, what's happening is that the Army Corps of Engineers has set up a comment period, and they are required by some of the laws that govern this process to read and respond and consider every comment that comes in. Likewise, what's happening is in the original report that the Army Corps of Engineers presented, they showed different models that they had considered. And some of the models do a better job of preserving the pool, the water height through downtown, than the one that they're recommending does. Likewise, Tanya and the Savannah Riverkeepers have come up with a plan that includes a whitewater area that's on the North Augusta side of the river, the rock weir, and then also some of the dam, which does a better job of preserving the pool and also plays into some of the concerns about flooding. In the comment period, they're asking other people to come in and say, here's our idea. We think this is a better way to do it because it also addresses some other concerns that residents might have who live along the river or people who use the river recreationally might have. Now, the challenge with all this is that any plan that is proposed as an alternative to the one that the Army Corps of Engineers is recommending has to officially be presented by either state or local government. And then secondly, those government entities have to come up with a way to cover the difference in cost. So although the rock weir that the Army Corps of Engineers is recommending has a price tag of just under $90 million, which is a lot of money, some of the other plans, including the ones that preserve the lock and dam and add the, you know, the white water on one side and, you know, all that kind of thing, cost more. So the question then becomes, where does that additional money come from? Mm-hmm. And that's a question that hasn't been answered yet in this process.
So, Drew, oftentimes these kind of development plans versus an endangered species get set up in very black and white terms. How is this going? How is this playing out?
You know, it will be interesting to see what happens with the comment period, because that gentleman that you just played, Steve Gray, as the conversation continued, he shared another very, very important concern with me that hasn't come up in the conversations that I've heard with the government officials. If the Army Corps plan goes into effect as it's outlined, which lowers the level of the water so dramatically through downtown Augusta, a couple things happen. One is that people who have boat docks, all of a sudden their boat docks are laying on flat, muddy land, mm-hmm. as opposed to on the river. On the North Augusta side in South Carolina, the way the laws are written, that land becomes the property of the property owner who had it before. In other words, as long as there's dry land, the property owners own the land from their house to the water's edge. So not that big a deal for them. However, on the Georgia side, that is not the case. What would happen is the property line would be identified as a certain elevation where when the property was surveyed, anything past that all of a sudden becomes dry land as a result of the water level lowering, it's no man's land. So the property owners don't own it. They don't know what they'd have to do in order to get permission to extend their docks over it so they'd still have access to water, or if someone could come in and build between their house and the water, thus eliminating them from having waterfront property, which, of course, dramatically diminishes their property value. We'll see what happens. The Army Corps of Engineers says emphatically, we are going to listen to and consider every comment that comes in. The City of Augusta and North Augusta have hired some engineering firms to develop a plan that is in the language and form that the engineers from the Army Corps of Engineers will understand, that will be an alternative to what's been presented so far, that again has as its goal making sure that the pool, the water level through downtown Augusta, is maintained, as well as allowing for the fish to move upstream and the industries to get their water.
If their plan goes through, when would construction begin, have they said?
Construction would begin in January of 2020 or 2021. I'm not sure which, but it's that far out.
Mm.
But I will tell you, Virginia, one of the other things that I think that's important here is there is a piece of legislation called the Water Infrastructure Improvements for the Nation Act of 2016 that requires the Corps to maintain the pool for water supply and recreational activities that existed on the date of the enactment, which was December 16th, 2016.
Uh-huh.
On that particular day, the water level was 114.5 feet above sea level, essentially a full pool for the riverfront properties. This plan has the water level through the pool at 108 feet above sea level, which is a significant difference. And so there's quite a great likelihood that this is going to end up in the court somewhere, because the law specifically says whatever you put in there has to maintain the water level as it was on December 16th, 2016, which is 114.5 feet. And the new plan is 108 and some change. So that's going to be a factor as well.
How is this playing out there? I mean, are you seeing lawn signs all over the place? Are neighbors talking with neighbors about this all the time? Is this the conversation?
I have not seen lawn signs. It is certainly the conversation. If you go along the Riverwalk and talk to just about anybody, they have an opinion on it. The comment sessions and the public meetings have been enthusiastic. We'll go with that. People have strong opinions on it. It's absolutely understandable. The environmental folks are saying, look, this is a fish that's been around for, 250, 300 million years. We have to save this. It needs to be able to get up to the Augusta Shoals. You knew what you were getting into when you bought riverfront property. This shouldn't be a surprise to you that these things happen. The lock and dam hasn't been used for its designed purpose since, 30, 40 years. As Tanya said, it's in bad shape. It will likely collapse at some point if something isn't done. So if that happens, then you're going to have a whole worse situation, because the water level is going to drop even more so than it would if the rock weir is put into place. There's a lot of different opinions, and it depends on what your priority is as to what will happen. I have to think, though, Virginia, that somewhere in the midst of all these options, there is one that meets all the needs, that allows the fish to get through, that keeps the water level at least high enough so that, boats don't have to worry about hitting those obstacles that have come up, that the Riverwalk is still pristine and attractive, and is affordable, or at least there's another money source to help cover those additional costs. That's what the hope is, that everybody wins. But we'll have to see.
Well, Drew Dawson, going for the solution there. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Drew Dawson, he is station manager and host at GPB's Augusta Bureau. We are going to keep in touch with you on this one, Drew.
Absolutely.
Well, that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and Amelia Brock. Alec Caslow is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley, senior producer. We always love to hear from you. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks so much for spending some time with us. This is On Second Thought.